Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro.
I'm Alicia Garcia Herrero.
And in today's episode, we will speak about the middle to high income trap in East Asia and its China dilemma. This episode is part of Bruegel's focus on global China as seen from Europe, which includes, as well, a monthly newsletter, Zhonghua Mundus, to which we invite you to subscribe. The link is in the show notes. Little promotion aside, we are very happy that Shirley Lin has joined us from Taipei to discuss today's topic. Hi, Shirley.
Hi.
Shirley is a Compton visiting professor in world politics at the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. She is also a non-resident senior fellow in the foreign policy program of the Brookings Institution and an adjunct faculty member at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. So, going to the topic of the episode, the middle-income trap is an economic development situation in which a country that attains a certain income due to given advantages gets stuck at that level. And we can say that the high-income trap is of a similar nature because although the positioning of these economies might be more advantageous at the beginning, yet they find it difficult to promote innovation in manufacturing or upgrade to higher value-added services to remain competitive and provide benefits to a wider spectrum of society. Shirley, you have widely analyzed the situation in East Asia and you have talked a lot about a high-income trap situation in several countries in the region. What is exactly the status of such situation over there, and what are the consequences in practice?
Thank you, Giuseppe and Alicia. It's so great to be on a podcast with dear friends. And I think Europe is more important than ever before, even though I'm based mostly in the US, Hong Kong, and Taipei. I think for your listeners, most of you have heard of the middle income trap, which have plagued many emerging economies because it is so difficult to graduate into the high-income status. In fact, for nearly five decades after the 1960s, only 13 out of 101 economies have succeeded, including South Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, and Poland, for example. Since 2008, Croatia, Hungary, Latvia, they've all come in and out of the high-income category while competing with countries that are coming up, like Malaysia, Turkey. But it is very difficult to not only get there and to stay there. But like most fairy tales, the ending is where the heartache really begins. After reaching the high income status, in other words, becoming wealthy, the East Asian economies have all immediately begun to see a slowdown in growth. Now, this growth went from double digit in the 1960s to low single digit right before the COVID pandemic hit. An important thing about the miracle is it is not an economic miracle only. It's really a political miracle. When it was experiencing all this high growth when I was a child, inequality actually declined and benefits were broadly distributed, which today you know how difficult that is in Europe and in Asia. With the pandemic, we witnessed more and more wage stagnation and what many would say the decline of the middle class. More fundamentally, the structural factors which have led these economies into the high income trap are not easily addressable. Japan was the first to enter the trap, and it seems deeply enmeshed in slow growth, high level of debt, and demographic decline, all of which you are familiar with in Europe. Young people don't have children. People live longer than ever before. So in all of these economies, fertility has been below replacement rate, and there's no immigration in Asia. So population is declining consistently. This is also exacerbated by what is known as financialization and asset inflation, of course. Financial crisis and pandemic means that accommodative monetary policy and low interest rate have led to the financial sector becoming more important as a part of the economy, and younger people have fewer opportunities as asset inflation goes on. Capital gains are much more important than working hard. So there's a generational divide between asset-rich older generation, stripping young people of opportunities. Now, finally, what I would say on this podcast with European listeners is that the social and political implications of the high-income trap for the middle class in these wealthy societies are far-reaching. Uneven distribution in favor of the elites have led to political alienation, growing support for extreme political platforms with rising inequality and high youth unemployment, these societies in East Asia are becoming more polarized as they try to find potential solutions.
Really, this is very interesting because what you are describing is basically those countries coming much closer to a political, economic and social demographic situation of European Union countries, for example. And when you describe exactly this motion towards a polarization of society and of politics, it comes to my mind what's going on in Europe. Isn't it, Alicia?
Yes, indeed. Thanks so much for this intro, because I think there is a lot of ideas out there that I'd like to kind of put in different buckets for our listeners. The first, I think, is the old idea, the idea we all know as development economies of middle-income trust. And that's basically overcoming an average income per capita. And that might be 10,000, you know, the usual numbers, 10,000 US dollar, that's where Turkey comes in. And then, you know, you mentioned Poland, so on and so forth. And that in itself is hard. You did mention, you know, countries, say Syria was about to get there. Look what happened. I mean, countries go back and don't actually overcome that middle income trap. But what you are saying is even more important and might bring us very soon to discuss China, which is that it's not only about the average income per capita. It's about how it is distributed that makes the difference. So your comments, I think, are well taken because they go beyond that average number and could go all the way to what you call high income trap, not even middle income trap, i.e. Japan. So you could be in that trap even when you think you've actually overcome it. And I think that's very powerful for Europeans because we might actually be there. So I just wanted to highlight those two differences, which I think were very clear in your introductory statement, but I just thought that it makes the thing much more complex, if I may say so.
Yes.
But zooming in to China, because I think this is one of the key issues to understand. I mean, China comes in this situation that you described, Shelley, and definitely changes a little bit the game of everything that has been happening in the region in the past 3-4 decades. Question is, will China fall into this middle income trap? And what is going on there? You know, how the situation of China basically plays within the frame of the region, but also within the frame of the issues that you highlighted within its own domestic development.
Well, first, I think Alicia's comments is very important, which is the whole concept of middle income and high income, which is a very big part of President Xi Jinping's sort of new idea or old idea. And like Alicia says, it's only an average. It doesn't mean everybody is benefiting as the country grows. And is GDP really all that important? This is a very interesting question that Europeans could appreciate. Or is it more important for people to be happy? And what does happiness really mean? So China is a very interesting case if we talk about first aggregate ambition to become a high-income country. Because while it's really worried about being stuck in the middle-income trap, which is defined by the World Bank as sort of being in that category of 1,000 to 12,500 per capita for over 42 years, then you're officially in the trap. I'm not sure what the definition really makes any difference, but it has already exhibited symptoms of a country actually in the high-income trap, and it hasn't even reached that. What do I mean by that? Well, not only has growth slowed down from double digit to single digit in the last decade, it has so many of the problems of the high income countries, starting with dramatic population decline. 2019 hit a historical low birth rate in the country's founding 70 years ago. But then in 2020, people were shocked. Birth rate dropped another 15%, with only 10 million babies born. This means fewer and fewer young people will be taking care of more and more older people. And while policy moved from limiting people to having only one child, now they're incentivizing, almost forcing young people to have more children. Women are not inclined to have more. And I learned from teaching mainland Chinese students for the last 10 years that they're not interested. Marriage is still a key factor in China for birth rate. It has plummeted by 41% in the last 6 years. So on top of this, inequality, which Alicia mentioned, inhibits growth. And it has widened in China more than in any of the East Asian economies that I mentioned, which are high-income economies, which naturally sees financialization and more inequality. But China has fallen into all of these challenges without ever actually having become a high-income country. So what do Chinese leaders really think? Well, during the 19th Fifth Plenum last October, President Xi Jinping made it very clear China was going to achieve socialist modernization and become a high-income country by 2035. That's really ambitious. And reaching GDP per capita of 30,000, three times what it is currently. Now, if China were to achieve this, from my point of view as a political economist, there will be two miracles that are necessary. Politically, so far, and my husband, Harry Harding, who's a US-China expert, always loves to say the miracle of China is a political miracle, not an economic one. Because without moving away from a socialist goal, it has actually been able to tinker with economic policy to fit the reality, to force development in a way that's politically actually not liberalizing. So politically, no large economies have reached a high-income status without democratization. So there are some resource-rich countries in the Middle East, which are the notable exceptions, and smaller economies. So that's the first miracle that's needed. Is that possible? Second, economically, middle-income economies also need to migrate from investment-led to consumption-led growth. And Chinese leaders absolutely understand this. So Xi Jinping has now a new idea, which is the dual circulation strategy to boost domestic consumption. This is even more important now because of the pandemic and tension with the US, which have reduced export and investment. Related to the second point is how inefficient China's investments have been because the market is not open and resources are misallocated. You can read Alicia's excellent piece on the Bruegel website titled China State-Owned Enterprises and Competitive Neutrality to really appreciate how wasteful China's investments can be.
Wow. Alicia, what do you think about all this?
I mean, I think Shirley's points on how hard it will be for China to really overcome that trap. And I don't want to define it as middle income, because again, we can just say maybe, yes, we can reach. You know, in a way, China has already overcome a middle income trap in the way we generally define it, because it's beyond $10,000 per capita. So that's not the trap. The trap really is about how to really create developed market society. Let's focus on the economics. A developed economy. And Shirley knows much more than me about the political requirements to do that. And I won't get into that. But that developed economy, think of any developed economy. Think about Japan or even South Korea. Actually, South Korea could be a very good example because South Korea has indeed moved beyond the middle income trap all the way to a developed economy. And it still has massive challenges. So poverty is concentrated in the elderly, because the welfare state is not that of Europe. So, you know, this Asian model of surpassing the middle income trap, except for Japan, I would argue, is kind of shaky because it doesn't have the pillars to basically achieve a decent, that decent is a kind of a value-driven word, but a reasonable, let's put it this way, reasonable distribution of income. And I think that's the core of the issue. How do you get there with a reasonable distribution of income? And it is very hard because, in a way, you've built a society which is, in some cases, and South Korea is, of course, not the case, it's still a democratic society, but in some cases, trapped by vested interests. And that makes it even harder to achieve that income distribution that allows you to call yourself a developed economy, not only having surpassed the middle income trap. So I guess the challenge there is much bigger than this 2035 target that Fifth Plenum has announced for China.
I'm curious, actually, Alicia, posing a question to my moderator, but you said Japan's an exception. That's really interesting because my goal when I went to college, when my teacher who just passed away, Ezra Vogel, wrote Japan as number one, my goal was to learn Japanese and move there and just live there for the rest of my life because there were so many wonderful things about it that were aspirational. And what has happened is Japan is actually the first to fall into the high-income trap in East Asia. The only difference between Japan and the rest of Asia and Europe is actually it has this, what you see is not asset inflation. But of course, it's really not able to have a more vibrant, dynamic economy. And it's just lingered. And the best example I always tell my student is the 7-Eleven that has been there for 30 years is in the same spot. Because nothing actually develops, nothing moves. The ATM machines, which move every 6 months in Hong Kong, never moves in Tokyo. It is just an evenly distributed middle-income society that is under a structure that never changes. And I think that this is quite scary for young people. And that's why there's a phenomenon where young people in Japan, they never go out. They live at home till they're 40, 50. And there is absolutely no growth. And this is what Alicia is talking about. It's not reaching 10,000 or 30,000. But when an economy is just stuck and wages stagnate, what are the opportunities for innovation, for further improvement, for productivity?
But Shirley, if I may, the situation in China, however we are going to see it, is going to be completely different from Japan, because the scale is completely different from the Japanese scale, both in terms of population, but the current development that there is over there. So beside these two miracles that might happen or not happen, that is more part of the discourse that is being crafted at the central level, China has been surprising us in the past 30 years several times. Do you think that it might surprise us again? It doesn't mean that they might not fall into the trap, but the way they might fall into the trap, or like the main they might develop, might change again the rules of the game.
Absolutely. China is an exceptional case, first of all, because of the size. You know, when I decided to study the high income trap, there are a few scholars that do it, not very many. The big difference is between small and large. A high income society like Hong Kong or Liechtenstein really have no resemblance. There's no lesson to be learned for China, although many people would say Deng Xiaoping admired Singapore and started with that kind of idea of state capitalism. But most of what China is doing is really feeling the stone as you cross the river. It's quite amazing what it has done. And I think China's miracle will be actually keep the value that it has talked about, a modern socialist society. What does that really mean? And how does distribution work? I would say that the biggest surprise here would be over the last 10 years of teaching mainland Chinese students is they are different than their parents. They are not willing to work day and night for the goal of making the country rich. And there's something more to it. And I'm not sure what it is. Watching young people talk about their goals and asking them why they don't want to have children, it's a dream for the older generation to have merely two kids. And today, young people don't even want to have one. And so the Chinese government's conundrum is that public policy does not work like in the past. And even though they've relaxed the one-child policy, nothing has happened in big cities. And people are not driven to do what the government top-down has decided you should spend. You should have more children. And so that would be a really interesting case of how would public policy work in such a large economy that has a changing generation with different values. And young people in China, frankly, want democracies as much as everybody else. They want a voice in policy. They want a voice in how their society is structured.
Alicia, you observe the evolution of the economy in China from very close, but also you have this global perspective that we try to bring in our China focus here at Bruegel. How do you see this playing around the region? I mean, we started with a look at the region. How do you see the evolution, like zooming out a bit from the domestic situation, how this has consequences in what is going to happen across East Asia? And also, which are the global consequences? You know, what we as European, we need to observe and watch for?
This is a very good question, and it brings me, although I may be pushing it, but I do want to respond to Shirley as well on Japan. So basically, Japan could be, put it this way, like a model. Not that it has to be a model, but an experience to compare China with. So Japan, yes, it is a smaller economy. China has more tools because in many cases, it can behave as a monopsony, meaning the largest buyer. So it has more bargaining power than Japan ever did. So that makes a difference because that gives you more room, if you see what I mean. Like maybe your country's return on assets is very low, but you are everywhere in the world and you determine, you know, the conditions. Japan never managed to do that. So, okay. So granted that China could have more room because of its size, which is the point you're making, Giuseppe, we still need to come to the reality, which Shirley was mentioning, that China's population is literally plummeting. And this is not only 2020 minus 15% fertility rate. It's actually true every year since they lifted the one-child policy, which is 2016. So it's not as sharp, but it's been always, you know, falling faster and faster. And let's face it, because I know many people will say this is because of COVID. No, it is not because of COVID. Children need to be, put it this way, cooked for 9 months. So 2020 is not COVID, okay? Because I hear this all the time. So So, or at least only 2 months of COVID. And that's not the reason.
We are also seeing that with COVID, we're going to see some sort of small baby boom kind of wave across the world. So we should wait for the data after the first semester of 2021, I would say.
Maybe.
But it's not that much of a joke here. I mean, I'm not speaking about too much of a joke aside, but...
Yes, it's a social experiment. So. Anyway, so what I meant to say is that China aging is becoming, not yet, but is becoming, at least the trend is very similar to Japan. So China could one day look like Japan. Forget about the size. And what that means is that it could be either Japan, i.e. stagnant, and Shirley described what it is, or worse than Japan. Because let's face it, when I said Japan is an example, I was referring to income distribution. So yes, you are stagnant, but at least you don't have a major social issue. You don't have populism in Japan, Giuseppe. Why? Because income distribution is not a problem. You have many other problems, but not that problem. And I think that's important because when we say it could look as bad as Japan, we forget to add it could look worse than Japan. By the way, Japan is also a major creditor, international creditor. It's accumulated huge external assets. It is not clear to me whether China will manage to do so per capita, meaning to be a, you know, like a economic history, a rentier, like you just live out of your savings. It will be much harder for China to live out of your savings. So what I'm coming to, and now your question on the global impact, is that China might actually grow much less before it becomes rich. And this is a common phrase that we hear all about. So these two ideas. One is, you know, China dominating the world, and because China can impose its own standards, its own conditions, no matter whether it ages, it just manages because it's basically the new superpower. That's one. And hopefully because of that, they will manage to improve on income distribution. So I wish, but it's not certain. But the other one, which is even more gloomy than Japan, to be frank, for the reason I mentioned, is that you may not have enough resources to distribute income. Because, you know, look at how fiscal expenditure is being distributed in China. There's a lot of data out there that social expenditure is actually falling as a percentage because there's many other things that need to be paid for, from military expenditure to others. You have the likelihood of a pension problem increasing. You have health expenditure basically ballooning, which is actually not covered for or catered for. So, you know, this idea of grandiosity of China, which frankly, I wish it will, because it's good for the world in a way. I mean, maybe not the superpower part, but the fact that it will do well. I mean, nothing against it. But it might be an overstatement because there's so many contingent liabilities that we're not taking into account. And I think that's important. So I wish China well, but looking like Japan, no matter how stagnant, to Shirley's point, might actually be a dream if you think about it. And that's important to realize. So the 2035 might look X, 20,000, but the question is which income distribution? And what about welfare state in China? What about our pensions being paid? What about the health expenditure and all of the rest? And that is what I mean by a developed economy. So it is a big issue, I think, that China will need to deal with in the next few years.
If I may add, Alicia, and maybe Shirley can say something about it, because we've been speaking about income distribution within the population and so on. But when I think about possible things that can go wrong in China and that can go wrong differently from Japan or other places, exactly because of its size and geography, and also about the fact that, you know, urban development on certain areas is different from the rural areas and so on. I almost think that one realistic scenario in case things go wrong is like, rather than the whole economy going down altogether, the risk of this polarization that is social, that is economic and so on, will be very much also a geographical polarization, like still having some pockets of hyper-modernity over there, while other parts will lag behind. I don't know how much of this reflection is in this thinking about the high income trap, the way it can manifest in a country like China. What do you think, Shirley?
No, this is really interesting. Moving away from comparative political economy, if you look at international political economy, the redistribution in the world is between the East and the West the last few decades. And this has had huge global implication. Among high-income economies, of course, China is both a driver and an outcome. It's a solution and a curse throughout Asia, and of course, the United States. And you could see the backlash coming from the United States about 10 years ago, starting then. You could already see there was a huge problem with the huge amount of low-cost, labor-intensive goods being distributed worldwide. All the economies needed China economically to buy from China, to sell to China, and now to get investments from China, as there's an overaccumulation of capital on the Chinese side. But of course, the consequences can be very severe. Now, I wanted to add to what Alicia said on the domestic side. China has all of these issues, but an example is social welfare, what they call Dibao. Basically, the system actually is not designed by economists like Alicia. They're politicians who have the basic interest is for the party. So they use policy to shape, just like fertility policy, which we all know is not effective because it takes more than a decade to convince people they should behave a certain way, especially in terms of having family and having children. And the issue with China, of course, they spend a lot of time analyzing political and economic outcome and shaping those outcome in a certain way. So welfare is given, actually, with some political goals in mind. And I think that for the rest of the world, as China starts to spread their investment, and with the recent investment agreement, of course, with Europe, the issue is really a very, very important issue in Asia, where I'm sitting. I'm sitting in Taipei. And my last book is called Taiwan's China Dilemma. It's exactly about this. Should we take Chinese money or should we not? What is the consequence of taking Chinese investment? And I think the whole world now falling into economic difficulty will have to think about this more, especially where political spillover are intended by Chinese investments. And this clash of values is quite evident. So where I'm sitting in Taipei, basically, this redistribution, if you will, from 30 years ago, where Taiwanese businessmen go to China to impart know-how, technology, or basically not only capital, but labor. Today, basically, young people in Taiwan, one of their most important prospects is to go to China to work and to find opportunities there, and hoping, of course, for Chinese investments to come to Taiwan, whether to invest in their startup or to go public on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. The possibility, of course, of all of this Chinese investment around the world is that in Asia, where they have geopolitical goals, this money comes with strings attached. And it's quite important to think about what will happen as Chinese capital comes into Australia or to Taiwan and it infiltrates the universities or the private sector. How would that change our way of life? How would that change a democratic system? And I think the opportunity for China to help the high-income trap is as important as the concerns about what it would do to all these high-income democracies.
Sure. I think this is one of the main concerns that we need to take into consideration, right, Alicia, when we look at the perspective globally and regionally of all this.
Yes, I think Shirley's point is very important, because once we move away from China for China, meaning China's middle income trap or high income trap or income distribution, everything we just said, and we actually look at implications globally of whatever happens in China, that's when, you know, kind of the consequences of everything we've said become huge for anybody. Yeah. And in a way, scary, because it's such a huge experiment. We've never seen anything like that in recent history. I don't mean to say in history, because I don't know history well enough, but certainly in recent history. So I think that the implications of all of this is that if it goes well, will it be too much? Meaning China superpower, what does it mean for our values, our models, you know, the fear of the unknown or the known that we do not fully share. Yeah. But the other one, if it goes, if say the scenario where this income distribution doesn't improve, there are social issues, you know, there's not enough resources for a country of the size of China, where actually expectations were very different, because, you know, this is not, say, the good old China where the expectations were and what they are today. So if you actually come with such a shock for a population that, in a way, does believe it's going to be the major superpower, I mean, this has big consequences on their self-confidence and blah, blah, blah. So is the world ready for either or? That's basically the point I want to make, that in both cases, I don't think we're ready either for the superpower or the super disaster, put it this way, because of the size and implications. And I think this is why we basically, I mean, my call is for, I don't like the word engagement because it's been overused and I think it has the wrong connotations. But I like to say that about caring for what happens in China and having these discussions, you know, and trying to understand that half full, half empty glass, what it means for us, and hopefully it won't be full or empty.
I totally agree with Alicia, Giuseppe. I just wanted to say that the analogy, of course, of this being too black and white is very important because it's also a problem in Washington, D.C., where basically it's engagement or it's confrontation. You know, what about healthy competition? And the big issue, of course, is that the experiment in the last 20 years when things weren't so confrontational was that the Chinese capital started to come slowly into Taiwan and to Hong Kong for the last 30 years. And what has happened is inequality has dramatically widened. Why? Because the way Chinese capital engages with other economies, even though Hong Kong today is not the other, it's part of China. But basically, when it was still engaging sort of on an arm's length basis, what Chinese capital usually does is engage with elites. And so it always further a group of people to get rich faster. And it's not widely distributed, which is a domestic issue in China and also an issue when China starts to engage with European countries and also with its neighbors. And South Korea is also evident. So I think that the idea that mainlandization comes with all the high income problems, worsens the high income problems, especially during the pandemic as well, is very worrisome. And I wanted to say that actually Europe is a very important guiding light. When I started to get into academics 30 years ago, moving away from the private sector as a venture capitalist at Goldman Sachs, I remember the academic community was still fascinated by the European Union. That was the big experiment, not China. The EU was the big experiment in mankind of different communities getting together to collaborate and compete on a healthy basis. And those theories that date back to the 60s about functionalism and how working together in business and technical issues could lead to a federal system of government in greater China. That was what we were all thinking. Maybe that's the lesson from Europe. But today, with the changing European Union and Brexit, a more assertive China, all of this makes that research agenda from 20 to 30 years ago like a dream from another lifetime, unfortunately.
Well, you're very right. And this is kind of sad, especially seen from a Brussels observatory. But yeah, I mean, myself, I've been quite active in the youth movements back in the mid-2000s, late 2000, beginning of 2010s. And I was coming to China quite often because they were looking at the EU exactly the way you described. You know, they were looking at us, the way we've been doing and forging cooperation, even on education, on skills, but also on governance, on participation at local level and so on. They were trying to learn from the EU. Now, I think the situation indeed is rather different. And yeah, and that's how we need to navigate. And that's why Alicia is completely right saying that we should care about what is going on at the moment, because that's part of, you know, whatever is going to happen to all of us. We are almost going through the end of this episode. We could go really on for a long time because it's super interesting. But coming back to the current affairs, let's say like that, we didn't touch too much, I mean, the situation with COVID, but how do you think COVID is changing the nature of the issues we discussed here, whether if it's the high income trap or this pressure from China or the future of young people, which you mentioned several times? How do you think this will play?
Yeah, we didn't talk about young people enough. And that's what I think about most of the time. I worry about their future. In addition to the structural issues we talked about in the high income trap, basically, COVID has accelerated all of the trends that we talked about, not reversed it or changed it. And I think that that's really, whether it's competition between the US and China, or it's the dependence on China, all of this has been really accentuated by the pandemic. Now, I think there's two things. One is what has happened to young people? Well, in the past 2 years and the past 20 years, really, young people in the areas where China really wants to have a dominant voice, namely Hong Kong and desperately Taiwan, I think that you could see the data. Young people in these places feel less and less Chinese. Now, that's a really interesting concept. What does it mean to be Chinese? It's very ephemeral. I'm Chinese culturally. I mean, I eat Chinese food and I read Chinese literature. That's how I grew up. But does it mean I am Chinese in terms of my value or politically? I think that's what it means when Hong Kong public opinion polls show that basically no young people between 18 to 29 consider themselves Chinese. That's pretty shocking from the high in 2008, where most people in Hong Kong felt patriotic and happy to be back with the motherland. Same thing in Taiwan, basically. Any kind of survey that should ask young people what they think, nobody wants to say that they actually are Chinese. They want to say they're Taiwanese. Now, usually that means something else. They want to exert their identity in a certain way, just like young people in Europe. They want to say something through these surveys. But I think that what it really means is they feel like they don't like the pressure exerted by a superpower economically, which dictate how they should do things, when they should do things, how they should do things. But I think the COVID situation has given us a wonderful opportunity to look at possible solutions to the high income trap, of which, unfortunately, in my 10 years of research, there are very few. There's really no solution to quantitative easing and, you know, interest rate moving in a certain direction. But I think Taiwan, where I'm sitting, and I usually don't live in Taiwan, but this past year has been quite unusual. I think it's an excellent example of a high-income democracy, which has spent years nurturing a good healthcare system and with sound public policy. And one of the lessons learned in the successful fight in Taiwan against the pandemic, with 23 million people, but only 9 deaths and less than 1,000 COVID cases, is that trust is unquantifiable and very important between the people and its government and among the citizens themselves. And the United States, which has such low trust in the government and among citizens, is a good counterexample because that's where I live half the time. I think this has allowed Taiwan to experience record-breaking export. So healthcare resilience and economic resilience are very interlinked. And with over 3% growth last year, Taiwan is going to achieve, by Alicia's estimate, probably over 4% this year, with an enviable sector, semiconductor and the information technology area. So I think the lesson for, of course, high-income economy is you have to nurture really innovative, and this is an issue in China. China is very, there are many, many thousands of scholars studying. Can an authoritarian system breed innovation? And this is for a separate podcast with many other experts who can join in. But fighting against the threat from China in Taiwan maybe has created the Taiwanese resilience on healthcare and economics that other countries that don't have such sort of threat don't have the sensitivity. And even though it's very polarized politically, there's no doubt in Taiwan, there's a lot of discussion about what to do with Chinese investments. But the high-income challenges I mentioned are still alarming, like Taiwan's household debt have reached over 90%. That's the newest data, way beyond average for high-income economies. But parts of Taiwan shows you that you can really do better. But I would say my best example I would leave for Sweden, of course, is the world's dream of any high-income economy, to have women who work, improve productivity, and have lots of children. And I think in that, Asia has no good example today.
Alicia, some last words from you before we close?
It's very hard to compete with Shirley. So, you know, if I stay silent, that's the best I can do. But I will use this opportunity, Giuseppe, to thank you for organizing this wonderful podcast. It's so refreshing to have an open conversation on these topics, you know, without any kind of constraint, to be frank. And I've learned a lot from Shirley. I think it's been extremely interesting for our European listeners, because it's a very different perspective. We think, and I want to end with this, that Asia is perfect sometimes in Europe, you know, that there are no problems in Asia, that they grow so fast, that everything is. And Shirley's bringing an idea, which is very important, that they do have problems we have. They may not have populism for a number of reasons we went through, but they do have aging issues. They do have debt, you know, household debt. They do have problems with productivity. And the future doesn't look as gloom, as amazing as it does sometimes look from the European eyes. So this is just to bring a little bit of that positiveness for European listeners, that we're not the only ones with problems. And there are others in Asia, especially on this front, that Shirley covered for us today.
Indeed, Alicia. And of course, thanks for the compliments for organizing the podcast. But thanks to you as well, because we are organizing this together. But what you pointed out is exactly what we are trying to bring in terms of fresh discussions with people from the region, especially with the focus on China. And we are going to have more of those kind of episodes. We did it in the past, but now we are structuring it more around this focus on global China as seen from Europe, which is our own point of view. And again, I would like to remind our listeners that we have a new monthly newsletter called Zhonghua Mundus, and we invite all of them to subscribe, and the link is going to be in the show notes in order to subscribe to the new newsletter. But having said that, I would like to thank you, Shirley, so much for your time, and thanks so much, Alicia.
Thank you, Shirley. It was wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you. So much fun.
And as usual, you can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars on our website, www.bruegel.org. Thanks a lot for joining to The Sound of Economics. Until next time, bye-bye.